I'm on page 7. How are things at Megalo? Asked Sir Ambrose. Greatly disturbed. We are having trouble with Juanita del Pablo. Luscious, languid, and lustful? Those are not the correct epithets. She is, or rather was, surly, lustrous, and sadistic. I should know because I composed the phrase myself. It was a smash hit, as they say, and set a new note in personal publicity. Miss del Pablo has been a particular protege of mine from the first. I remember the day she arrived. Poor Leo bought her for her eyes. Oh, oh. This Jewish producer sees this woman with beautiful eyes and buys her. Why does he buy her? For her eyes. She was called Baby Aronson then. Splendid eyes and a fine head of black hair. She starts out Jewish. So Leo made her Spanish. He had most of her nose cut off and sent her to Mexico for 6 weeks to learn flamenco singing. Then he handed her over to me. I named her. I made her an anti-fascist refugee. I said she hated... I said she hated men because of her treatment by Franco's Moors. That was a new angle then. It caught on. And she was really quite good in her way, you know, with a truly horrifying natural scowl. The woman is filled with anger at what's being done to her. And we have this vision of this starlet who's walking around just glowering all the time with fury. Her legs were never photogenic, but we kept her in long skirts and used an understudy for the lower half in scenes of violence. Please notice, it's a wad joke at the beginning of the book. What does it turn into? The half-visible Sir Francis in his coffin, where we keep the bottom half closed and as a result don't have to treat the legs or put pants on him when he's buried. Okay? And again, we have the sense of half people. Half real people, half phony people. Okay? Happening all the way through. I'll come back to this again, too. We also have at the very beginning that image of the dog's head being kept alive by the Soviets. And they just keep pumping blood into the brain so that whenever it's the smell of a cat goes by it, it salivates. Okay? Just a grisly image. But again, what is it? It's of a partial being. A being who is somehow only a piece of what a real human being should be. It's the reason why the characters in this book, in one way, seem slightly cartoonish. Not quite filled out. Because they can't be filled out. They're not quite real. There's a great moment in Waugh's Brideshead Revisited where he refers to Rex Mottram. And Julia says of Rex, he was something that only this ghastly modern age could produce. A little piece of a man pretending to be whole. And Waugh in The Loved One gives us a complete vision of partial, crippled, gutted, empty, fragmented people. And part of it comes in the very way he designs the characters, which is why we get a character named Mr. Joy Boy, okay? Who is almost as much cartoon as he can possibly be really human. He can't be really human. There's very little there. There's almost nothing there. Back to Juanita. I was proud of her, and she was good for another 10 years' work at least. And now there's been a change of policy at the top. We are only making healthy films this year to please the Catholic League of Decency. So poor Juanita has to start. By the way, at that point, there was such a thing, and it had some control in Hollywood. Gone. Gone. So poor Juanita had to start at the beginning again as an Irish Colleen. They bleached her hair and dyed it vermilion. I told them Colleens were dark, but the Technicolor men insisted. Please notice, again, there's no connection with fact. There's only what? What will look good in color up on the screen, okay? We're denying reality. There is no reality. There's just what will look good on the screen. She's working 10 hours a day learning the brogue. And to make it harder for the poor girl, they've pulled all her teeth out. She never had to smile before, and her own set was good enough for a snarl. Now she'll have to laugh roguishly all the time. That means dentures. Another little joke. Please remember when they're laying Sir Francis to rest, they say to Dennis, do you know what happened to his false teeth? Because the face is really misshapen if we don't have the dentures. Dennis says, I'll go to the police and see if I can find them. What begins as a joke turns into an ugly reality later in the book, okay? There is no detail in this book that isn't planted to be connected somewhere else. Waugh was a master craftsman. And his mother said at one point he should have been a cabinet maker. That he loved woodworking and he would have been wonderful putting cabinets together. And he probably would have been because he is a craftsman. And he builds his works of art in that way. They are perfectly, meticulously, and beautifully crafted, which is a necessary step before we get to great art. Okay? The craftsmanship has to be there first. I spent 3 days trying to find a name to please her. She's turned down everything. Maureen, there are two here already. Deirdre, no one could pronounce it. Una, sounds Chinese. Bridget, too common. The truth is, she's in a thoroughly nasty temper. We then find out, the joke is picked up later, Sir Francis is in trouble because her agent is now on him. Juanita's agent was pressing the metaphysical point. Did his client exist? Could you legally bind her to annihilate herself? When she signed the contract, did the studio have a right to destroy her? It's a joke. It doesn't become a joke when we remember how poor Amy ends up at the end of the novel. And she has been destroyed by those around her who have used her and manipulated her and given her no identity or substance to hold on to. And once again, a little joke becomes something absolutely deadly real by the end of the book. Okay? Now, this loss of identity extends beyond Juanita. Okay, she's Hollywood. And then suddenly we see how Hollywood becomes the seedbed for an entire nation. I'm on page 53. Bottom of 53. Dennis is complaining about American women. She left the room and Dennis at once forgot everything about her. He had seen her before everywhere. American mothers, Dennis reflected, presumably knew their daughters apart, as the Chinese were said subtly to distinguish one from another of their seemingly uniform race. But to the European eye, the mortuary hostess was one with all her sisters of the airliners and the reception desks. One with Miss Posky at the Happier Hunting Ground. She was the standard product. A man could leave such a girl in a delicatessen shop in New York, fly 3,000 miles and find her again in the cigar stall at San Francisco, just as he would find his favorite comic strip in the local paper. And there, the connection is made directly. Human beings are being turned into comic strip figures. Why? Because they're being created. They're a product. They exist only to do material things, buy the right things, perform a certain way, okay? They are products. They have lost all reality. And as a result, they are absolutely uniform. This is the reason why I say the little joke about the nut burger later. Waugh would have understood completely how the people became uniform and then suddenly the food became uniform. McDonald's in every town. The place where we would stay when we travel became uniform. A Holiday Inn in every town. The clothes we buy would become absolutely uniform. A Gap in every town. And no matter where you went, you got the standard product. And if you wanted entertainment, you go to the movie house and you all see Titanic for the sixth time. Absolutely standard. A person with nothing locally, nothing in terms of I am from this area and therefore I am like this. No, no, no. It's uniformity. All eating at McDonald's, all listening to Nine Inch Nails, all going to see Titanic, all watching Seinfeld, all staying at the Holiday Inn, all driving the right kind of Ford minivan. It is absolute uniformity. And in the midst of this, since you are nothing but a consumer of products, what do you become? A comic strip character with no more differentiation than a tiny little line drawing that could show up anywhere because you're all the same. There is nothing to make you real or to give you personality. And she would croon the same words to him in moments of endearment and express the same views and preferences in moments of social discourse. She was convenient, but Dennis came of an earlier civilization with sharper needs. Even as he's a scamp and a rascal, he's looking for more. He sought the intangible, the veiled face in the fog, the silhouette at the lighted doorway, the secret graces of a body which hid itself under formal velvet. He did not covet the spoils of this rich continent, the sprawling limbs of the swimming pool, the wide-open painted eyes and mouths under the arc lamps. But the girl who now entered was unique, not indefinably. The appropriate distinguishing epithet leapt to Dennis's mind the moment he saw her. Soul Eve in a bustling, hygienic Eden. This girl was a decadent. Now, Amy has been created by America, but she has roots that go way back. She's Greek, and hence the name Amy Thanatogenes. She has a European first name, a Greek last name, raised in America, and American in one sense in terms of a consumer of products and having the right attitudes and saying the right things. And of course, what her name means is beloved offspring of death. Beloved offspring of death. And though she may have this connection with this call from far away and the distant past, it is not enough to save her, and she is marked out from the beginning by her name for death. She may be Eve in a bustling, hygienic Eden, but sadly, she is going to fall, and she will come to know death just as certainly as Eve did. Now, the difference is, Dennis is tempted as Adam was tempted, but Dennis gets away. Dennis escapes, and one reason is, he is aware that that Eden is phony, and he is not willing to give up his soul, and that soul has to do with his desire to create art. He's a poet. He's not necessarily a good one yet. He's not necessarily one who's done much work, but there is something in him that keeps him going forward, that keeps him moving. Now, I want to go to Whispering Glades now. We get there through Sir Francis, of course, and what's happened, the link, and it's magnificent, Sir Francis is, in a way, like so many others in the book, a foreigner who has come to America, been Americanized enough that he loses his identity. And that which he held on to that defined him is lost. The book itself, the opening of the book, is one of Waugh's greatest. I'm at the very first paragraph, because we begin with a false front. The book itself begins by doing what the whole novel will do. The description at the beginning, we're at Sir Francis's home. All day the heat had been barely supportable, but at evening a breeze arose in the west, blowing from the heart of the setting sun and from the ocean. Okay? It shook the rusty fringes of palm leaf and swelled the dry sounds of summer, the frog voices, the grating cicadas, and the ever-present pulse of music from the neighboring native huts. It sounds like we're in Africa. In that kindly light, the stained and blistered paint of the bungalow and the plot of weeds between the veranda and the dry water hole. It's the swimming pool that's empty. But it sounds like we're off in one of the barbaric regions of the world with these Englishmen who have been posted there and are doing duty for the empire. Waugh's point, we are in one of the barbaric outposts of the world. It's called California. It's a wicked little joke with which the book opens. The Englishmen who are posted there have chosen to go there. And in going there, they have lost their souls. Sir Francis talks to Dennis on page 14. He's remembering a Christmas play he saw as a child in England called Where the Rainbow Ends. St. George and a midshipman flew off on a carpet to rescue some lost children from a dragon's country. It always seemed to me a gross interference. The children were perfectly happy. Children are quite happy being enthralled to the dragon. They paid tribute, I remember, their letters from home, unopened. Your verses are my letters from home, like Kierkegaard and Kafka and Scotty Wilson. I pay without protest or resentment. Fill my glass, dear boy. I am your memento mori. I am deep in thrall to the Dragon King. Hollywood is my life. He knows he has sold his soul to the dragon. Hollywood has become his life. And he will become Dennis's memento mori, reminder of death. And what happens to Sir Francis? He has fallen from power. The swimming pool is empty. Starlets used to swim in it, we're told, okay? He is a hanger on at the studio, and then there's that ghastly scene where he goes, and he doesn't exist anymore. What he has done to Juanita has been done to him, and his name's off the door. And in its place, the name tag, Lorenzo Medici. We're told it's pronounced that way because the other way sounds too European. Lorenzo Medici, who is some nephew of another studio executive who's sitting there saying, yeah, I don't know why I'm doing here. I just cleaned out all kinds of junk, some old Britisher who died. And Sir Francis says, I am that Britisher and I am not dead. But he will be momentarily wiped out, the identity gone. He was enthralled to Hollywood. He didn't escape, okay? He couldn't escape. He became entrapped, loses his identity, and therefore takes his life. Therefore takes his life. And the vision is identity gone, life ends. And it is a book that is filled with these suicides. Dennis then this is the memento mori. Dennis has to start thinking of death. He goes to Whispering Glades, drives in, and now we get the sense of Whispering Glades as phony religion, as a missionary priest making his first pilgrimage to the Vatican. That's Dennis going to Whispering Glades, okay? As a paramount chief of Equatorial Africa mounting the Eiffel Tower, Dennis Barlow, poet and Pets mortician, drove through the golden gates. You've got to read those sentences aloud to get the majesty, the beauty, the humor, style, just stylistically impeccable. He drives in and there, the marble sculpted open book, letters a foot high was incised the dream. Behold, I dreamed a dream. And I saw a new earth, sacred to happiness. There amid all that nature and art could offer to elevate the soul of man, I saw the happy resting place of countless loved ones. And I saw the waiting ones who still stood at the brink of that narrow stream that now separated them from those who had gone before. Young and old, they were happy too, happy in beauty. Happy in the certain knowledge that their loved ones were very near, in beauty and happiness such as the earth cannot give. I heard a voice say, do this. And behold, I awoke, and in the light and promise of my dream, I made Whispering Glades. Enter, stranger, and be happy. And below, in vast cursive facsimile, the signature, Wilbur Kenworthy, the dreamer. We get the parody of Scripture. We get the perverse parody of the Constitution of the United States, the pursuit of happiness, life and the pursuit of happiness, where there is no death. Everything is happiness. And then we get that which is pure Americana. We go behind the facade, this magnificent sculpted marble open book, and then the little wooden sign. A modest wooden signboard beside it read, prices on inquiry, administrative building, drive straight on. And now we get down to the practical facts of, come on in, pay your money. Okay? Throughout the time in Whispering Glades, we get this disconnect and realize this is all pumped up and phony. It's like the magnificent moment when the hostess is showing him around and talking about the wonders that they can do with the loved ones in making them look good again. We had a loved one last month who was found drowned. He had been in the sea a month and they only identified him by his wristwatch. They fixed that stiff, said the hostess, disconcertingly lapsing from the high diction she had hitherto employed, so he looked like it was his wedding day. The boys up there surely know their job. Why, if he'd sat on an atom bomb, they'd make him presentable. Horrifying. But please notice what we have. It's a phony religion. What does it promise? Happiness, salvation, the easing of pain. There will be no more troubles. No more troubles. Everything. And the major trouble, what is wiped away? Death. Death is no longer painful. Death is no longer a problem. Death will be prettified. Death will be made happiness. The loved one's gone to a better place, and all these euphemisms. And of course, the waiting ones are just on this side of the stream, and they'll cross over, but they can plan ahead. They can choose their spot, know right where they can choose their little island where they want to be. They can choose their work of art. Dennis sees the stone child with the stone Mickey Mouse clasped to his bosom. It's just grotesque. There are one or two moments when Waugh makes his point clear and hits us with it. I'm on page 41. This is right after the woman's been spraying the scent over the lilacs. Oh, Mrs. Bogolov. This is another woman talking on the phone. Oh, Mrs. Bogolov, I'm really sorry, but it's just one of the things that Whispering Glades does not do. The dreamer does not approve of wreaths or crosses. We just arrange the flowers in their own natural beauty. It's one of the dreamer's own ideas. I'm sure Mr. Bogolov would prefer it himself. Won't you just leave it to us, Mrs. Bogolov? You tell us what you want to spend, and we will do the rest. I'm sure you will be more than satisfied. Thank you, Mrs. Bogolov. It's a pleasure. Mr. Bogolov had wanted a cross on his grave. No, 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 we can't have that. little comment from an essay that Waugh wrote about when he first saw Forest Lawn. There was a book that was put out, he got a hold of, called The Art Guide of Forest Lawn with Interpretations. Mr. Bruce Barton, author of What Can a Man Believe, says, quote, "The cemeteries of the world cry out man's utter hopelessness in the face of death. Their symbols are pagan and pessimistic. Here, sorrow sees no ghastly monuments, but only life and hope," unquote. Waugh says, "The Christian visitor might here remark that by far the commonest feature of other graveyards is still the cross, a symbol in which previous generations have found more life and hope than in the most elaborately watered evergreen shrub." Now, he will not say anything that directly in the novel, okay? But he will present, we get that little moment, we don't allow crosses in here. We'll just have some nicely arranged flowers. The flowers will be phony with scent sprayed over them. That's in the same paragraph as the lilacs. Okay, not even the flowers are real. Everything is, again, I'll take the time and do this quickly because it's, Dennis is there looking around, and comes upon, I've got the wrong page written down. One second, I will find this. There we go, page 78. The Church of St. Peter without the walls, which the dreamer has reconstructed. I'm at the bottom of 78. You will observe that the side aisles are constructed solely of glass and grade A steel. There is a beautiful anecdote connected with this beautiful feature. In 1935, Dr. Kenworthy was in Europe seeking in that treasure house of art something worthy of Whispering Glades. It's like a big antique store that you can go and rob and bring good pieces that will be worthy of Whispering Glades. His tour led him to Oxford in the famous Norman Church of St. Peter. He found it dark. He found it full of conventional and depressing memorials. "Why," asked Dr. Kenworthy, "do you call it St. Peter without the walls?" And they told him it was because in the old days the city wall had stood between it and the business center. "My church," said Dr. Kenworthy, "shall have no walls. And so you see it today, full of God's sunshine and fresh air, birdsong and flowers." The birdsong is taped, the flowers are plastic. Okay? And it's not a church. And at this place of death, religion is gone. Gone. There is no place for it because religion reminds us of the actuality of death. Dennis is assured, the hostess asks him, what was your loved one? What religion was your loved one? He says, agnostic. And she says, well, we have two non-sectarian chapels. And all through the book, she says, Jews and Catholics prefer to make their own arrangements. Point being, those people still seem to believe something. All the way through, we get the jokes about non-sectarianism, which is basically all these religions popping up everywhere that really don't believe much of anything. And it continues throughout until finally Dennis catches on and announces he's going to become a non-sectarian minister. Now, if human beings have lost all that which makes them human, beginning with the soul. And if you remove religion, you remove the soul. Any sort of society to live in, any sort of culture, culture is gone. Any sort of sense of connection with place or other people. These people do not connect with each other. They use each other. The wonderful comment of Sir Francis at the beginning. They love talking here, my dear boy, and the nice part about it is they don't expect you to listen. The most basic connections of human beings, conversation, gone. The fact is there is nothing left of them, and they become like animals. And thus we get to the other grand parody, if you will, the happier hunting grounds, okay? Now the joke, of course, comes from the Native American, the Indian tradition of the happy hunting ground. You die, you go to the happy hunting ground. Well, no siree. You die, and in this world, your pet goes to the happier hunting ground, which is much nicer than anything in the beyond, okay? And from the beginning, we get the, this is bottom of 23. And the complaint is some of these people don't care enough about their pets to give them a decent burial, and they're cheap. Not all his customers were as open-handed and tractable as the Heinkels. Some boggled at a $10 burial. Others had their pets embalmed and then went east and forgot them. One, after filling half the icebox for over a week with a dead she-bear, changed her mind and called in the taxidermist. These were the dark days, to be set against the ritualistic, almost orgiastic cremation of a non-sectarian chimpanzee and the burial of a canary over whose tiny grave a squad of marine buglers had sounded taps. It is forbidden by California law to scatter human remains from an aeroplane, but the sky is free to the animal world, and on one occasion it fell to Dennis to commit the ashes of a tabby cat to the slipstream over Sunset Boulevard. That day he was photographed for the local paper and his social ruin consummated. The point being, we get a mockery of human funerals in the pet cemetery. Okay? I'm on page 82. And the link between the humans and the animals is made at Whispering Glades. They are no longer any different. Why not? If you abandon reason, if you abandon the soul, then the human animal becomes just an animal. We're back with that ferryman who takes him across again, who has some great moments, okay? This is right after the beehives. I'll do this quickly. It certainly is a poetic place to be planted in. Costs around about $1,000. The poeticest place in the whole darn park. I was here when they made it. They figured the Irish would come, but it seems the Irish are just naturally poetic and wouldn't pay that much for plantings. Besides, they've got a cemetery of their own downtown being Catholic. It's mostly the good style Jews we get here. They appreciate the privacy. It's the water, you see, keeps out the animals. Animals are a headache in cemeteries. Dr. Kenworthy made a crack about that one annual. Most cemeteries, he says, provide a dog's toilet and a cat's motel. Ah, pretty smart, huh? Dr. Kenworthy is a regular guy when it comes to the annual. No trouble with dogs and cats on the island. Dames is our headache. Dames and guys in very considerable numbers come here to neck. I reckon they appreciate the privacy, too. Same as cats. And suddenly you have men and women performing animal rites in the cemetery, just like the animals do. And in case we missed the joke, while he spoke, some young people had emerged from the bosque and stood waiting his summons to embark. Paolo's and Francesca's, the couple from Dante's Inferno, in the circle of the lustful. Paolo's and Francesca's emerging from their nether world in an incandescent envelope of oblivious love. One girl blew bubbles of gum like a rutting camel, but her eyes were wide and soft with remembered pleasure. They've become animals. They've become animals. And then we get the funeral ceremony at the happier hunting grounds, on page 122, where an Alsatian hound is being lowered into the flower-lined tomb, and the Reverend Errol Bartholomew is reading the service, top of 122. Dog that is born of bitch hath but a short time to live, and is full of misery. He cometh up and is cut down like a flower. He fleeth as it were a shadow, and never continueth in one stay. Later in the office, as he gave Mr. Bartholomew his check, Dennis said, "Tell me, how does one become a non-sectarian clergyman?" "One has the call." "Yes, of course, but after the call, what is the process?" "I mean, is there a non-sectarian bishop who ordains you?" "Certainly not. Anyone who has received the call has no need for human intervention. You just say one day, 'I'm a non-sectarian clergyman,' and set up shop. There is considerable outlay. You need buildings, but the banks are usually ready to help. Then, of course, what one aims at is a radio congregation." "A friend of mine has the call, Mr. Bartholomew." "Well, I should advise him to think twice about answering it. The competition gets hotter every year, especially in Los Angeles. Some of the recent non-sectarians stop at nothing, not even at psychiatry and table turning." "That's bad. It is entirely without scriptural authority." Please notice, the humor gets more and more exaggerated. You can't miss the point until finally we get Dennis's own card that he hands out that Sir Ambrose has gotten a copy of and confronts him with. Bottom of 156. "Squadron leader, the Reverend Dennis Barlow." He's a military non-sectarian. "Begs to announce that he is shortly starting business at 1154 Arbuckle Avenue, Los Angeles." Wish I had time to go into the Fatty Arbuckle story. There's a whole separate thing. Big movie star from the 20s. "All non-sectarian services expeditiously conducted at competitive prices. Funerals a specialty. Panegyrics in prose or poetry. Confessions heard in strict confidence." Religion becomes a money-making scheme. Just a money-making scheme. And then finally, what does it come down to? Well, what we get finally is this. Amy, who has been given nothing her whole life, okay, who has that distant connection with Greece, sort of her real homeland, but even that is tentative, who has no education, who has no family, who has no religion, who relies on the Guru Brahman, who is also a phony. He's, you know, the Guru Brahman, three people, a secretary and two guys, one of whom, Mr. Slump, who is this alcoholic, chain-smoking lout, who's the one giving her advice, which again, a hideous vision of what she has come down to, the vision of the Greek woman going to the oracle at Delphi to hear the gods speak to her, is now listening to Mr. Slump. Okay? Again, a ghastly sense of the trivialization of something that was once solemn and majestic. And his advice, if I were you, I'd go take a jump from a tall building. Okay? And it's the only voice she has left to listen to. The two men that have loved her have not loved her. Dennis is after one thing, the rascal. Okay? And in one of the letters that she's written to the Guru Brahman, she admits that she's aware of what Dennis is after. Sometimes he is very sweet and loving, and then he suddenly becomes unethical and makes me feel unethical too. She's very proud that she has ethics. She has no idea what it means. Absolutely no idea what the word means, but she might have picked it up in psychology class and she uses it. What happens to poor Amy, of course, she is wooed by Dennis with phony poetry. It's not his. She thinks he's loved her enough to write poetry for her. And she's wooed by Mr. Joyboy with corpses that he puts loving expressions on the face of. What is she wooed by? The two men who claim to love her woo her by dead poets and dead bodies. She is the beloved child of death, and death is all around her. Her only occupation at Whispering Glades, prettying up corpses, making death look pretty. What is she devoted to? What is her work? Death. But not even confronting death in a realistic way. We get the sense, I'm on page 134. Amy Thanatogenes spoke the tongue of Los Angeles. The sparse furniture of her mind, the objects which barked the intruder's shins, had been acquired at the local high school and university. She presented herself to the world dressed and scented in obedience to the advertisements. I don't have time to do the jungle venom thing. Read it again on your own. It's a screen. Brain and body were scarcely distinguishable from the standard product. But the spirit, the spirit was something apart. It had to be sought afar, not here in the musky orchards of the Hesperides, but in the mountain air of the dawn, in the eagle-haunted passes of Hellas. Her spirit is still Greek, and the moment comes when she goes to the oracle, a phony oracle who doesn't care for her and will give her phony advice, cheap advice, a joke. And by the way, please notice, he's just been fired. Another construct. Beginning of the book, Sir Francis loses his job, which was a non-job. End of the book, Mr. Slump loses his job, which was a non-job. There are no real jobs for these people anywhere other than where? Whispering Glades, the place of death. She takes the advice. She takes the advice of Mr. Slump. Go take a high jump. And suddenly, God, this is wonderful, 149. Please know, I'm going to... Waugh suddenly makes us care for this woman at the same time we're laughing. This is still comic, but suddenly it's painful. Her mind was quite free from anxiety. Somehow, somewhere in the blank, black hours, she had found counsel. She had communed perhaps with the spirits of her ancestors, the impious and haunted race who had deserted the altars of the old gods, had taken ship and wandered, driven by what pursuing furies, through what mean streets, and among what barbarous tongues. Her father had frequented the four-square gospel temple. Her mother drank. Attic voices prompted Amy to a higher destiny, voices which far away and in another age had sung of the Minotaur, stamping far underground at the end of the passage, which spoke to her more sweetly of the still Boeotian waterfront, the armed men all silent in the windless morning, the fleet motionless at anchor, and Agamemnon turning away his eyes, spoke of Alcestis and proud Antigone, and we get the list of the heroines of Greek tragedy. And now Waugh is giving this ironic comparison between these great Greek heroines who made great tragic ends because their gods called them, and poor little Amy, who is about to make her end, follow, if you will, the old gods of her race in this diminished, barbaric, puny outback of the world in which she lived. I'm on 150. She took the lift to the top story where everything was silent and empty, save for the sheeted dead. She knew what she wanted and where to find them. A wide-mouthed blue bottle and a hypodermic syringe. It is science destroying nature again. It is the place of prettifying death that brings death. She indicted no letter of farewell or apology. She was far removed from social custom and human obligations. The protagonists, Dennis and Mr. Joyboy, were quite forgotten. The matter was between herself and the deity she served. And who is her god? Death. Death. And the place that seeks to avoid death and prettify death has become the place of empty, soulless death. And Waugh won't tell us, but it's very clear, Satan has triumphed. He's gathering souls. It's a horrifying moment. He gathers her soul how? Where does she end up? She doesn't even get a nice funeral at Whispering Glades. She's burned in the crematorium at the happier hunting ground, because she has been reduced to the status of an animal. And Joy Boy takes her there. And when he walks in, we get the confusion with Dennis saying, oh, Mr. Joy Boy, not another parrot so soon. Dennis has no connection with her. He does the job, gets money from Joy Boy, gets the check from Sir Ambrose, but he's going to escape. He's going to escape. This is just horrific. all the way through, planted throughout the book, the little joke of the cards that are sent every year to those who have had their animals cremated. And the last joke of the book is horrifying. But Waugh has been preparing for it for over 100 pages. And when it comes, we are complicitous because we laugh at her, we laugh at the joke, and it is horrifying. The fire roared in the brick oven. Dennis must wait until all was consumed. Meanwhile, he entered the office and made a note in the book kept there for that purpose. Tomorrow and on every anniversary, as long as the Happier Hunting Ground existed, a postcard would go to Mr. Joyboy. Your little Amy is wagging her tail in heaven tonight, thinking of you.
Oh.
On this last evening in Los Angeles, Dennis knew that he was singularly privileged. The Strand was littered with bones and wreckage. He was adding his bit, something that had long irked him, his young heart. He was carrying back instead a great shapeless chunk of experience, the artist's load, bearing it home to his ancient and comfortless shore, to work on it hard and long for God knew how long. It was the moment of vision for which a lifetime is often too short. He picked up the novel which Miss Posky had left on his desk and settled down to await his loved one's final combustion. The loved ones are not loved. Everything is upside down. Dennis is a scamp and a rascal, but we kind of like him because he's making his way through this world and he escapes. And what does he leave? That old romantic youthful heart. What's he taking back? What Waugh took back from California. A horrifying vision of a fact to be shaped into a work of art that will tell a great truth. And we assume in a curious way that Dennis's poem that he would write is somehow equivalent to this bizarre, macabre, unusual little book, which is also a great work of art and at bottom a profoundly religious vision of what happens to a society that denies its God, attacks nature, and forgets that death is the moment of agony when soul and body separate and the human being stands before his judge. And that fact hovers behind this book from the first page to the last, even though, with typical modern comic irony, Waugh does not have to state it. But as we laugh, our blood should be chilled. And it's the reason why, even in this season of Lent, this is an appropriate read, because it forces us to take death very seriously, in spite of the laughter.
Is there a subtle stab back in England, do you think? And the scene in the beginning where Sir Ambrose comes over for the drink, and it describes them as having a chivalric bond.
Absolutely. And he is a total phony who capitulated completely, which is why he's still around and still successful. But you'll notice, again, the costume he's wearing is outlandish and somehow not quite appropriate but he's a mixture now of Britain and Hollywood. And there is a sense that he views himself as a knight, but he's completely given himself over to the film world, and the film world therefore sanctifies him. He's all right. They've known that they never really had Sir Francis. He was enthralled to them, but he never really believed it, which is why he can be shunted aside and ends up being destroyed. Sir Ambrose is a phony, again, a complete phony. Sir Francis was real, but still trapped and loses the only things left, the only attachments he had left to life. I neglected it. The ghastly poem that Dennis writes to be read at the... Oh, they told me, Francis Hinsley, they told me you were hung with red protruding eyeballs and black protruding tongue. I wept as I remembered how often you and I had laughed about Los Angeles, and now 'tis here you'll lie, here pickled in formaldehyde and painted like a whore, shrimp pink, incorruptible, not lost nor gone before. It's just horrific. Just horrific. But again, what is it? It's the reduction. It's really, that's what he's been reduced to. And there's that wonderful moment where Dennis has the shock of looking on the face of death and talks about how horrible it is to find Sir Francis hanging there. See that face that is no longer human, contorted, and the soul has left it. But it's not as bad as when he goes back after they've made him up and painted him up. And he says it looks like a grotesque mask. And that's more horrifying than looking on the face of death itself. Dennis still has a few basic real instincts left and realizes that that painted pretty picture of death is much more horrifying than the real thing, because the real thing is real death. It's not pretty. It is ugly. It's meant to be shocking. And that's why this phony world tries to pretty it up and cover it over. Horrible. Horrible. Yes.
Lorenzo Medici, was that any relation to the Medici family in New York?
But he uses the name. And the joke is, it's somebody who's picked up the name, doesn't know how to pronounce it. And the figure we meet has no connection with royalty or nobility or a patron of the art. But of course, he's there working in the studios now. And again, you have the sense of the debasement of art, the debasement of a great name, okay? And because it's Lorenzo Medici, not even Lorenzo de' Medici, okay? It's just sort of somebody saw the name. And again, we have the sense of constantly renaming things. Somebody saw the name, liked it, didn't know how to pronounce it or what it meant, took it and is using it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's, again, more phoniness, more falsehood. Thank you very much.